The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
I'd submit that there's a paradigm shift that's happening where you have folks who are seriously considering what it might be like to go fight with AI. And before, that had been kind of a science experiment.
Greatest benefit of AI to the warfighter, is it truly a CCA, like an actual, like an F-35 with no pilot that thinks on its own? Or is it data collection and processing or something like that? Like, where do we live, like, on AI as like the biggest capability or greatest contributor of a capability to the DoD, if you've seen one so far?
I became a big LinkedIn guy when I was getting out of special operations, and they said, hey, you know, we are quiet professionals, but we're not silent professionals. And when you get out, you're entering a world where there's a lot of noise. So your job is not to add to the volume, your job is to create signal.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Afterburn Podcast. I'm Flash McVeigh here with a good buddy of mine, Forrest Underwood, a guy that I've known for going on. It is going to be about 19 years, about 5 days ago, from June 30th of 2005, when we both showed up for in-processing day at your United States Air Force Academy. what a time. But I was talking
to Forrest. You don't look any older. That's amazing. Me, on the other hand, like I look and feel, you're younger. You're actually better looking than when we started the academy. I don't know how you do that.
I don't know if that's the truth. I got a lot more gray than these days, but we were talking before we started recording about kind of going to the Air Force Academy, and me and Forrest, we played flag football against each other, with each other, all those different things. Once you're there, kind of in it, doing all the sports and things like that. But you kind of forget that sometimes when you're at a place like the Air Force Academy, we did a lot of dumb stuff. And the things we talked about might not have been as high level as what we might talk about today, but the caliber of people that I find myself looking back on and being like, you were surrounded by some pretty incredible people, and with that, I don't put myself necessarily in that category, but Forrest is one of those dudes. So current founder and CEO of Evergreen Industries. So basically a company that helps defense tech startups, is what kind of the do. And then we're going to talk about that in depth here in a minute, but, Forrest, welcome to the pod. Would love to just kind of hear some of your background. I know you were a tactical airlift. So how does someone go from being a C-130 pilot, in the Air Force to now kind of working in the Space Force Global Partnerships Directorate as a reservist, as well as being a defense tech startup CEO?
Yeah, there's no playbook for it. I'll tell you that. I think when it's Hunter S. Thompson that said, like, you know, buy the ticket, take the ride. I mean, that's essentially what I did. I mean, like, even just to go back before flying C-130s, you know, I grew up in a Navy town in Jacksonville, Florida, and watching Top Gun and, you know, seeing the sea air and, you know, all the air shows and the Blue Angels flying over. And like, all I ever wanted to do my whole life was be Maverick. And I'm bagging groceries at Publix at my, you know, my job in high school, and a student of flight suit walks in. I was like, oh man, like you're the guy, you're Maverick in real life. And he goes, no, I'm in the Air Force. Like, what is that? So he's like, come out to the base and I'll show you. So I like drive out to the airport to the Florida Air National Guard, where they fly F-15Cs. The dude is the wing commander of the FANG and invites me over, shows me an eagle. He's like, what do you think? I was like, done. Awesome. And he's like, well, have you ever heard of the Air Force Academy? I was like, yeah, do I get to do this? And he's like, yeah, of course. It's like, cool, I'm in. What do I do? He's like, the application's free. You got to go talk to a congressman. You get in, yada, yada, yada. And no surprise, as a, you know, late junior in high school, trying to get into the Air Force Academy with kids that have been wanting to do this their entire life, they go, hey, you know, you seem like a pretty interesting candidate. You probably need to go to prep school though. you know, make sure you're focused, make sure you understand what's in store here, make sure you'll be successful. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. So I went to Northwestern Prep, got into the academy the next year, the class of 2009. And then, yeah, my whole time at the academy, all I wanted to do was fly jets. And, you know, what's the old saying? Be what, you know, be number one and get what you want. And I'm like, great, let's do it. So at T6, I do the best I can. I get the top stick award. And they're like, hey, it turns out the Global War on Terror doesn't need a bunch of air superiority fighters. So like everybody head out down the hall, you're all going down to the T1 squadron. And I'm just kind of like, what? And they're like, yeah, this is the need of the Air Force, like happening right here in front of you. So that was probably the first like real moment in my career where I started to realize like, you're just along for the ride. Yeah, you do the best you can, but you're kind of just along. It was actually a good thing that happened to me because I got this brand new airplane that no one even knew about called the C-130J, because my flight commander is like, dude, no one knows what this airplane is, but it's at Ramstein. Like, that's where you're going. Enjoy. Thank me later. And it turned out to be incredible. Yeah. Because I flew all over Europe, flew all over Africa, got to respond to Benghazi, respond to Crimea, got selected for special operations. They were buying the new MC-130J. I had international experience, so they sent me out to Kadena out in Japan. And that was when KJU was lobbing rockets toward Hawaii. And got to do a bunch of the interesting missions around the Spratly Islands. And it was like, okay, like there's something happening over here, before it was cool. And then when the full-scale invasion happened back in Europe, I moved back and was part of the Special Operations Command staff working on that problem. So, I was lucky enough to get picked up for a program called Defense Ventures in Cohort 1, where they sent me out to Silicon Valley for a couple of weeks to learn about venture capital. Like, I have no idea what that means. You know, I'm a knuckle dragger, pilot, staff officer. Hey, you need to come out to this thing. And I'm like, that sounds awesome. There's no way I'm going to get a boondoggle approved out to Silicon Valley for 2 months. But I had a really awesome boss. You know, the commander was like, hey, this sounds really interesting and maybe something we could use. So discussing out there, COVID happens. You know, we immediately turned all those networks out in Silicon Valley into things that we could use to fight the pandemic. And I met our classmate, Jack Ambridge, along the way. He had just finished business school and was going to a company called Shield AI. And he's like, dude, you have this like interesting SOCOM experience. You have this interesting Silicon Valley experience. We're trying to get our AI that we have on quadcopters onto fighter jets. What do you think? And I was like, yes, let's go do that. So I spent 2 years doing that. And I got recruited to a company called True Anomaly, where we're trying to put AI on satellites. We had a baby, so I decided that you get one startup at a time. I grossly underestimated how much time a newborn takes.
It's a startup in and of itself.
Dude, it's like 10 startups every day. It's like a startup. So I ended up taking some time off, but I started getting calls from investors and founders and buddies of mine who were like, hey, I'm working really hard on something. I know that you have some experience working in defense tech. Can you help? And that turned into helping buddies out to being a real business that I built around, you know, Evergreen Industries. So yeah, kind of a long winding path, but it's been incredible. I'm loving it. And every day I get to wake up and do the mission just, you know, wearing a different jersey.
That's right. That's right. And yeah, just like we started with, speaking of surrounding yourself with incredible people, like we're talking about Jack, when you say what he just got done with business school, that was Harvard Business School. is what he was finishing up. And you're just like, oh yeah. Okay. Jack Ambridge, football player at the Academy, Harvard Business School, AI, all these different things. Incredible stuff. And then kind of transitioning like where you kind of, so artificial intelligence and then also into space. So how did you kind of navigate that from, again, just being a pilot, you seeing how AI became kind of at the forefront of defense tech at the time? And then now how that transitions into space? So some of the things that you're doing both on the uniform military side and in your own company, talk to us about like some of like space innovation and how that's going and what the difference is kind of between what we've been doing in the past as far as defense tech companies and how kind of different it is when you start to talk about in space.
Yeah, it's helpful to go back. We'll rewind the clock a little bit and think about how the space industry got to where it is today. You know, and you think about in the 60s when, you know, Sputnik is circling the globe and becomes this, you know, the space race, and we're trying to build rockets as fast as we can and get men out to, you know, on orbit, much less the moon. And yeah, that really galvanized the nation around innovation. You know, NASA's got these crazy budgets where they're doing these, you know, amazing things, and they're just making huge leaps in technology. And that really propelled things forward. And then, you know, basically, like, once we were like, hey, check, we've done it, we've landed on the moon, you know, NASA continues to explore, but they're not getting, there's not the same sort of impetus and energy around it. And even though they've gone on to do, you know, lots of incredible things around space, it basically has remained kind of an inherently governmental market. You've got, it's incredibly expensive. It take, you know, just a launch, like the barrier to entry is super high. Yeah. Like the components on a satellite, you know, like these things cost billions of dollars. So yeah, no startup's going to get in the game, you know, like, it, you know, who's got all the heritage, who has all the experience. It's all these guys that worked at NASA and, you know, the big company, the big primes that have supported government programs. So SpaceX comes along and is like, hey, not only are we going to create launch as a service, like we're going to land these things on boats and we're going to offer ride shares to small companies that can, you know, launch, we can launch hundreds of satellites a day. And it's just, yeah, that fundamentally changed the game. And we're also seeing, you know, the price of satellites come down, you know, the components are coming down, they're becoming more commoditized. You're seeing more companies that are saying like, hey, if I can launch stuff super fast and I can build it really cheap, I can actually just create a service out of this. So the government doesn't have to buy my satellite, you know, they can just buy a service and I'll just continue to send them up and have them do their missions. And when they're done, either, you know, to, you know, bring them in or refuel them potentially. There's all kinds of cool technology out there, but that is because there's now the barrier to entry has come down and all these new entrants are entering the market. So I'd say that space innovation is now, it's kind of having this renaissance where, you know, private capital is flowing into the market. So people can go raise money to hire world-class talent, build incredible products to solve really hard problems that, you know, what do they call it? 10x better for 10x cheaper. You know, when you can start showing a pretty credible pathway to that, to those kinds of numbers, like, yeah, investors get really interested. But it's still incredibly hard. Like, yeah. A, it's hard to build brand new space assets, satellites or sensors or otherwise, if you don't have those decades of experience. And even if you hire people like that from some of these other agencies or these other companies, you know, they probably don't have the same sort of skill set that, like, you know, people that worked at startups do, people that are used to going fast, people that are used to doing low cost, attritable, innovating on a daily or hourly basis. So there's sort of a culture clash that happens too. And then, of course, the market still thinks about the government, you know, like the primes and other governments being their customers. They don't really think about these new companies that are moving fast and like cycling tens or hundreds of times in the same sort of period that these traditional defense vendors or, you know, defense space vendors are producing. So that the paradigm is shifting and you're seeing not only a lot of capital, like the barriers have come down, capital's flowing in, new kind of interesting ideas and new people are starting companies to solve some of these problems. And we're just getting started.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Cause like, how often, it's kind of a question, kind of a statement a little bit and then discussion. Like, seemingly, like when guys sit around and talk like that are in the military, they come around and they start talking about just capability gaps. Man, I wish we could do that. I wish this would become something that we could potentially do. I wonder if there's someone out there who does this. Is your company trying to like take those gaps that the military does and then pair them with people that already do this or people that do something kind of like it? Is you're saying it's like, hey, there's this company out there that does something that could kind of touch this space. And I bet they could figure it out if you paired the right military mind that knows how things work with the right tech mind that knows potentially how to accomplish just like the difficult things like on a computer that I know I don't know how to do. How often do you see that where it's just like a discussion of does somebody do this because we have this gap? And then how often has that happened in kind of your kind of sphere?
I have to laugh at the guy who literally taught at the F-35 weapons school saying that he can't do things on a computer. I appreciate the sentiment, but dude. Well,
all right. You know what? That's fine, because we're talking F-35s. Is yes, it is a flying computer. I do know how to do that, because this is actually like where the one person can touch the two, so to speak, is where it's like, I know I need the airplane to do this. Yeah. And I know the computer works like this. I just have to marry those two up. How do you do it at scale with two large entities, if you will? So we'll rephrase the question. Thanks.
I don't think anyone, but you just described it. Like, I don't think anyone's figured out how to do this at scale. At best, we've got companies like Anduril and Shield AI who are like getting into programs of record and are like actually at the same table providing credible technology solutions to these like really challenging national security problems, like stuff that, you know, you could throw billions of dollars at a traditional defense company and they would just never be able to solve because they don't have the talent. They have access to the tech, but they don't cycle as fast. The budgets are finite and these programs are, most of them are cost plus fixed fee. So yeah, they're not incentivized to go faster. They're not incentivized to do better. So yeah, like you end up having these challenges and like, we're still working through that. And I think that's part of what makes this like space so interesting is if you have what you described, which is, you understand the operational concepts, like, the problems that need to get solved. You also understand the technology, like, where the gaps are, what the state of the art is, what the state of the practice is, where things are going, like, you can actually kind of see where these things might intersect. The third aspect of this, it's like critical, is business acumen. It's great that like you understand the problem and you can build a credible solution. How do you actually bring that thing to market and make sure that you can build a business around it? Because the one necessary and sufficient condition for a business to be successful is paying customers. That's it. Like, there's no magic to this. Like, if you understand the problem and you build a great technology solution, but you don't have a paying customer, like, do not pass go, do not collect $200. It doesn't matter. And there's lots of people that really understand how to build amazing tech out there. No question. There are a lot of people that understand, they've spent years, decades in the Pentagon, or they've spent, time at the weapons school, and they've done things, they understand these problems deeply. But how do you get these people to like talk in the same language and work on the same level, and then also build a business around it? And that is a hard challenge, particularly for startups that are entering a very sophisticated market where there's barriers to entry, like security, and it's capital intensive, and you have massive primes and you have program managers that aren't, even if they're willing to take risk, like, maybe they're not allowed to because the schedule is so tight or the budgets are so tight. Like, if they make one bad bet, like, everything goes sideways.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think in essence, that is what I set out to solve at Evergreen, is take the lessons that I learned and all the scar tissue along the way, having these like very unique kind of operational experiences, having this really unique experience out in industry, going to business school and like learning the first principles and the fundamentals and putting all that together to make sure that like, hey, you think you need to develop a requirement here, but all you really need to do is come to the table with a problem. Just come and just tell me what sucks, what's hard, what are you missing? And we can put a lot of really smart people on that, look at it and figure out like, hey, maybe there's a couple things here we can do. And then you have some smart business people or who are maybe like actually the same, you just kind of suss it out and build a business model around it. It's like, okay, yeah, now we potentially have a company here.
Yeah.
And I think that's like what I try to do at Evergreen is make sure that before we go raise money, before we go make any huge commitments, or before we go down, a path, because a 1 degree deviation in the near term can be a massive pronounced difference over the course of a very short period of time. Let's make sure that we're totally aligned here, so that if we go push this thing up to max AB, like, we're going in the right direction, because it doesn't help anybody if you raise a bunch of money and you go as fast as you can the wrong way.
Yeah. And that's kind of one of those that leads me to kind of an offshoot kind of question when you were talking about these big primes and other things like that. Does a kind of a startup failure, like that one degree of deviation that you raise a bunch of money, you get like a contract that then doesn't come to fruition. What impact does that have on like another company that's trying to do something of the same? Like when you're trying to now take something and produce and provide a capability to the government, is there like a healthy, a good skepticism, healthy skepticism, or a bad amount of kind of animosity between the government side and the startup side about just like, you need to have everything fleshed out before we even think about giving you a contract? Or is it a pretty cordial relationship on both sides? And like, does the government want these companies to provide this capability? Kind of, if you understand, if I asked the question correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people working in these roles, because there's like, there's not like one single decision maker. It's not like, in technology companies, you're typically selling to someone like a CFO, a chief financial officer, or like a chief product officer or something like that. Like someone who has the authority and the budget to just make a decision like, hey, I've got this tool, it solves all the problems that I need, I've got the budget, like, boom, let's do it. Like you have one buyer. And if that guy doesn't like it, you have hundreds, if not thousands of other companies that have, that are in the market that you ostensibly like can solve that problem for to go after. You know, in the government, it's not just one person, but you do have, you know, all these different stakeholders you have to align. You've got the warfighter, like, yeah, like it's got to solve my problem, but cool. Like I don't write checks and I don't make any decisions. Yeah. You get the acquisitions people that have to come up with the acquisition strategy, right? They have to like look around the market and see what's, you know, do some comps. And it's like, hey, by the way, if you've raised money on this, there's like probably not anything else like this. It's probably pretty new. There's not a whole lot of market comparables out there to contrast it with. It's moving incredibly fast, but like, how do I even assess that? And then you have the requirements people that are sitting in the Pentagon or wherever, you know, whatever they're working, trying to think about like what the 2040 problem is and like take that problem statement and break it down into, you know, tangible pieces that they can wrap their head around and they can give to an acquisition person to go out and look in the market to buy. It's like all these things are just, they're really hard when the pace of the threat changes so fast. The pace of technology is changing even faster, which is driving the threat and also driving us to try to like wrap our heads around just the problem and solution space. Meanwhile, like you've got budgets that Congress expects you to execute and provide the capability that they've said in the national security strategy and the military strategy, like, hey, these are the things that we said were important. You said you could go do this. You said a budget request. I gave you that money. Now you're telling me, no, I need more money or I need to spend it on different stuff because the threat's changed. Like, well, yeah. Right. So like this is a multivariate problem. It's really hard to solve.
Yeah.
But it is tractable. Like we actually hit, like this is something that the like innovative companies, particularly startups, like, you know, kind of prescribed to the Silicon Valley ethos, they understand. And if you think about things in terms of machine speed, like if you're moving at the speed of software, as opposed to like always trying to move at the speed of hardware inside of the system, like you can actually start to solve some of these, you know, it becomes more tractable. But I think to your point, you know, the difference between startups and primes, like I think there is a cordial relationship in that people at the, you know, at every level are saying, yeah, we know we need better solutions and we need to make it more cost effective and we got to deliver them faster. It's just really hard because the system doesn't really exist to do that. I mean, we built a system that was built for making B-29 bombers and aircraft carriers, you know, and B-2s and B-21s. Like we didn't build a system that makes CCAs or like software as a weapon system or, you know, like, and we're trying to get those two things to reconcile is probably not going to happen in our lifetime. Like that is, I think, one of the things that most people in the innovation world would say, like, oh, if we could just get the PPBE process to be reformed, like all will be well. Well, like there's a reason we have the system, like, and there's a reason we don't want to buy an aircraft carrier every 6 months. Like, yeah, you know, that's just infeasible. However, there are concepts out there. You're starting to see this with like cyber budgets and with like Raider funds at OSD and like AppFit programs and different things where it's like, hey, bring the thing you told me that you went and raised money to from Silicon Valley to go solve. Like we'll test it in an operational context. We'll give you feedback and then you go back and iterate on that as fast as you can. And we'll try to build some steam. And it's essentially kind of a parallel pathway in addition to the normal process. But if you're waiting on the big machine to change, like, don't hold your breath. You got to find other pathways and other ways to attract the right people to the market and then get them in across the valley of death onto the other side.
Yeah. And when you're saying don't expect this process to change in a quick manner or within our lifetime, like I think it was, all right, I might butcher the actual bill or like our concept, but I think it's the Deficiency Act. Like we still run the defense budget the same way we did in 1884. So yeah. It's when we sit there and like how we fund the military, there has been some changes. It's not always on a 2-year POM cycle. There is some future spending that's out there. But it's still an antiquated process. That's both. I talked about this with an individual, Stiffy Sitzer on a previous pod, where it's like, you want the inefficiency because that restricts like power being put all in one place. You want like a healthy amount of inefficiency, but then you also want an efficient process. And our governmental Department of Defense, any of these acquisitions process is not efficient. And therefore it almost slows people down, but it's still a pretty good system. But yeah, it's kind of some of these that I've seen in talking to you before is that you just have this problem. And then you've got a company over here that's like, yep, we can absolutely do that. And then you're talking about moving at the speed of software and just being like, hey, yeah, we can shift and we can maneuver and do some of these different things that provide capability to the DoD, which is pretty impressive to see, which is interesting. You brought it up, because tell me this, you worked for Shield AI when Blue Heron did the versus F-16 kind of thing with DARPA. That hurt my heart, by the way, to watch that. I remember I told you this story, but a buddy of mine in my weapons school class was the pilot on that one. And he texted all of us the night before and he just goes, hey guys, just letting you know, there's some things going on in the background, but you're about to watch me get worked by an AI F-16 tomorrow. And he did, but Banger, you did great, buddy. I still love you. But so as far as that,
what a great American, but like what a great American for like getting in the seat on TV and just saying like, yeah, dude, it turns out this is a great tool. And showing the world, like, how awesome would it be if we put this thing on our side?
Exactly.
That was the paradigm shift.
Yeah. And so that happened about 5 years ago. So what's been kind of the path of what, when we take a look at some of these things that you put out there as far as tech and what it was originally designed for, what we originally tested it with is not necessarily the finished product. But so when you look at that, like that instance that we all got to watch on TV, like what has that morphed into? From your different times, I know you've moved on to like 2 to 3 different things after that, but what does that capability kind of give us when we talk about CCAs? And is that something that we're looking to potentially see? Is there issues or what have you kind of seen since then, since Blue Heron then kind of came under Shield AI to take that forward?
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from national public data. You might be asking yourself, what's national public data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description again to get 14 days free.
Yeah, I think probably the most impactful outcome of that whole thing is the amount of talent and capital and innovation that's now entered the space. Like you said, I mean, air dominance has been largely dictated by, you know, like the primes, programs of record that exist, you know, that you've flown and been a part of. And as like as cool as the block upgrades are and as like exquisite as some of those systems are, there are still huge gaps because the threat keeps evolving and the enemy gets a vote. And like China is being very explicit about like what votes that they're going to make. and you're seeing what's happening in Russia, like, you know, the EW that's going on there. You're seeing the use of drones become more impactful in the Middle East, you know, and like, so there's all these things that are just changing all these paradigms that we have, just like, hey, let's go build a more exquisite fighter. Let's go build a more exquisite bomber. Let's go build more exquisite missiles. And if you're like, yeah, right. Yeah. So at some point, you know, when you're in, you know, all the air dominance folks and, you know, joint warfighters here will, you know, say like, okay, Forrest, like, this isn't anything new. However, I'd submit that there's a paradigm shift that's happening where you have folks who are seriously considering what it might be like to go fight with AI. And before that had been kind of a science experiment, you know, DARPA did this, and Anibal Jaworczyk, you know, was like, shout out to him for starting the DARPA ACE program. And, you know, Heron did an incredible job beating companies like Lockheed Martin at AI. And it just proved to these kind of small companies out there that are doing cool tech, like, hey, you can participate, you can get involved in missions that actually matter. And now we're starting to see things, and like, the Air Force isn't the only example. Like, you look at the Navy Disruptive Capabilities Office and what Mr. Stewart has done, where he was the N9I, you know, doing innovation across the Navy, and then he took over the unmanned task force, and now they built an office around the system that he's created around disruptive capabilities. And he's going to the fleets, and he's going to the COCOMs and saying, hey, that problem that you said you got and like no one can solve, like, I got a solution for you. And oh, by the way, like, it doesn't come with a multi-$100 million bill. Like, I can deliver it tomorrow for X dollars, and it is fraction of the cost. And he's actually putting points on the board. So he's, you know, organizations like this are, they now have credibility with the warfighters, like real credibility. Yeah. They have real credibility inside the Pentagon. So like, the people are going, hey, like, when I go to Congress and they're beating me over the head and shoulders about why is this program late? Why is it more expensive? You know, it goes, well, hey, over these are cost centers, but over here we're actually like, we're making money because we're solving real problems. We're building real capabilities. And oh, by the way, I don't have to foot the whole bill because all this private capital is now coming into the market. So it's leverage for me. Like, I get to sit in the middle and go, yeah, really hard problem. You guys want to work on it? Cool. Like, you know, you put your money in, here's actual money, meaningful contracts on a mission and a customer who really wants you to succeed. And you start seeing things like that work. It you can't help but go, all right, there's a different way to do this.
Yeah.
And in DARPA ACE wasn't the first example, and there will be many, many examples after this, but I think it's important to realize that, like, it wasn't about a dogfight. It wasn't about getting beat 5-0, right?
Yeah.
It was about opening our minds to new tech and new operational concepts to bring better capabilities online faster.
Yeah. And that's kind of that's a little bit of the fear too, right? When you look at, when you put it on, I remember the conversation that we had was, there's a lot of people that, even the people that were a part of the experiment and Glock, who kind of was the play-by-play John Madden announcer of the, actual thing.
Yeah.
Being like, incredible. Ooh, it was like,
he's got a career in that after the Air Force. Yeah.
Oh, it was a beautiful thing, dude. It was a beautiful thing. But when we looked at it, was, I will say that for about 9 months to a year after that, was, I saw that it was kind of people saying, okay, an artificially intelligent pilot is better than a manned than a fighter pilot. It's like, cool, now we're just going to have all these different unmanned fighters that act the exact same as a fighter. That's that's not, just like what you're saying, is that wasn't even the point of the experiment. It was just kind of one of the things that we look at. And then, in your opinion, it seems that AI is in vogue across the board in the Department of Defense, and a lot of the senior leaders that just go out there, and even people in Congress, when they stand up, I think it's one of those, if you just say AI enough, your program or something sounds credible. Like, what is the biggest
or not.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you're just saying AI, and that's not really an understanding.
Yeah.
You don't really understand. And I will say, be fully transparent and admit, like, I don't really understand it as much as I probably should. But when we look at it, is, what is your thoughts as far as the greatest benefit of AI to the warfighter? Is it truly a CCA, like an actual, like an F-35 with no pilot that thinks on its own? Or is it data collection and processing or something like that? Like, where do we live, like, on AI as like the biggest capability or greatest contributor of a capability to the DoD, if you've seen one so far?
The answer
Do you think
yes.
I'm going to be out of a job? Do you think I'm going to be out of a job?
All boats. No, not anytime soon. I mean, I honestly believe AI is like the most like amazing technology. Like, I don't fully understand it. Anybody that does, I think, is, you know, a bold-faced liar. You get people like Nate Michael, who's the CTO at Shield AI. Like, he is a professor at Carnegie Mellon. And I remember being on a call with him and one of our, you know, customers, because every single call you ever had with anybody was like, well, what is AI? Like, well, yeah, how do you even define AI? And like, it just, you start there. You got to get people to understand it before you can get them to believe it and much less commit to it. And there's a huge mountain to climb when you're getting people to like to understand AI, right? Like, this isn't, it's not like X's and O's. I can just sort of like hand wave it. But you really need someone who is like deep understanding of this technology, who has experience in discipline. And he was like uploading PhD theses that he sponsored during the call. He uploaded like 20. He's like, hey, if you have more questions on this, feel free to read any of these, because like all your questions will be answered in the thousands of pages of text are here. Or you just take my word for it. Like, I actually understand what's going on here, and we can just move forward past the like, yes, this is credible, and like, let's figure out how we can use it conversation. And I think, like, to your point, what's the most valuable use of this? I think there's so many use cases. I was actually, you know, in my role at Evergreen, I'm fortunate that I get to work based on my experience. I get to work with some of the, you know, pretty high level decision makers who are thinking about this, and they're trying to answer that question. And they've gone from trying to like understand the ones and zeros of how AI works, and they just go, okay, cool. Like, LLMs are here. I want to figure out how to use them. And the thing that they're now kind of focused on is like, how do I use them in a trustworthy way? How do I make sure that the thing that I'm asking it to do and the output that I'm getting is something that I can trust? Because at the end of the day, you know, Mike Benitez talks about this, and, you know, Paco and I work together at Shield. There's TRL, technology readiness level, and there's the other TRL that people don't think about, which is the trust readiness level. Like, is the end user going to trust it? Does the command, will the commander sign off on it? You know, will Congress accept it? Like, there's all these different layers of trust. And whether it's like the acquisitions process, just making sure that companies, you know, the acquisitions folks are soliciting for proposal, companies that are writing these proposals, like, we can make that process go from months to like days or hours even.
Yeah.
And it's not like you're offboarding this out of your brain. You're just taking all this rote work that machines can do, you know, thousands of times faster and innumerably better. And we're giving it to a machine for a human to make a decision about. And I think that's the, like, the reason you're not going to be out of a job. And that's the reason that we're thinking about combat collaborative aircraft and like man-to-man teaming as these future concepts, because yeah, there's something like the most exquisite platform on the planet is the human brain. And how do we then enable that to utilize all this information, utilize all these tools in the right way? Part of it's acquisitions, you know, writing contracts and developer programs. Part of it is the end user out there figuring how to get more missiles on rails downrange, all really hard problems. But if we are able to leverage these tools, like, we're going to be able to evolve much, much faster, but it all starts with trust.
Yeah. And that's kind of the, I'll probably ask a dumb AI question here in a minute, but the, actually it's not dumb. It's a question that I've actually heard and been asked in my career. But one of the things that I've looked at is just allowing automated processes via algorithms and data going in equaling data coming out is something that I've seen that is absolutely crucial. So one of the problems that we have in the Air Force, like specifically with F-35 or fighters or bombers or anything like that, is long range kill chains. And so you're looking you've only worked on some of those problems a few times in your career. But so when I see it, is the amount of data about the enemy, the amount of ISR, like things that the ISR constellation collects, the amount of data that we have is immense. In Afghanistan specifically, a story that I had was just like the thousands of hours of predator footage that they had. and they couldn't watch it all. So that was kind of one of the things that we look at is now I have seen at weapon school, and I've seen in exercises, and then sometimes even in contingency operations, where the person who is finalizing the targeting data going into my cockpit is a human sitting at a keyboard looking at something on Merc, and they're typing it in. And I can tell you, like, it's on more than these two hands, the number of times I've seen a human type in a 5 instead of a 7. And when they're looking at like where we're going to drop this bomb. And I was just like, why can we not just have this automated, like, where can AI help me with this situation? And I think that's something that when you look at it, is all of these different places where something can touch only help us. Logistics, like how to most effectively and efficiently maneuver, just like you're talking about, missiles around a large piece of Earth, like maybe the Pacific, I don't know. But like, how do we do that and make it efficient? And I just think that this can only help as far as those things. So as the dumb AI question that I was going to have, this is more of a conspiracy question. Do you foresee, because I've been asked before, do you foresee in our lifetime, yous and I as Forrest, a machine unmanned that drops a weapon in anger without the consent of a human? Do you see that happening in our lifetime?
I don't know.
I'm laughing when I say this, by the way. But
yeah. I honestly don't know. Because I think in extremis, you know, when acceptable levels of risk get high enough, people start doing the calculus and they go, okay, like, am I going to send Flash and ever this warship of F-35s to go like penetrate the walls of an A-21 Bravo? Like, or do I just send a couple of CCAs out there to soak up some missiles, maybe lob a couple down and, you know, get a couple of kills? It's like, that calculus makes sense to me. Now, will the policymakers do that? Will they agree to that? You know, will the collateral damage be worth it? Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot that goes into that conversation, but it's not totally off the table that given the circumstances, given the ALR, given the risk to force that, yeah, like you can see a conversation and a decision getting made where something like that is totally feasible. I think the more interesting question around getting to that answer is how do we, just like any scenario, like how do we train for that? How do we try to make sure that the first time the first time we're thinking about that question isn't in that situation?
Yes.
And you lived at Nellis. Like, this is your job. Like, you go out there and you push the envelope, given the tech you have, you know, and just down the road at Edwards, they're out there trying to push the envelope of like, hey, what tech can I give to these guys? How do I get it out of DT and into OT and like into the cockpit as fast as possible, or onto the ground or onto a ship or onto a satellite? And that process still takes way too long. And then one of the things I think about for industry is, you know, these companies who are, they don't have the reads that you and I have. So they're like, hey, I've got this incredible solution. I think it's going to solve long range kill chains. I'm like, cool. There's like 7,000 things between where you are today and where you want to go that you may never know. And that's a problem. And like, they don't need to know everything, but they need to know some things so that they can solve the right problem, and they can think about integration, they can think about communication, they can think about operations, they can like do all those things that are gonna be necessary and sufficient to get to that end goal, or at least like make progress that way. And that's like, that's one of the hardest parts, is, you know, security is just a massive barrier to entry. And if you don't even understand the problem, how can you begin to start solving it, much less practice with it, much less play with it? And I think that's the big thing that like we haven't really wrapped our heads around, is like, at the speed the threat's evolving and the speed that the technology is evolving, how do we like rapidly get reps on this stuff so that if the balloon goes up tomorrow, God forbid, like we've got something in the kit that we have trained with and we are ready to go fight with, and we have some frameworks in our mind to think about how to begin answering some of these really hard, complex questions.
Yeah. And security, Raid Auto, he's a F-22 guy. When he talks about security hates America, security doesn't necessarily hate America, but it is a problem. It is a problem. But
yeah, it's hard. Yeah,
yeah. because you also you have to protect yourself. And when we talk about those need to know, yeah. But the number of times I've seen, and you've probably seen it as well, if you have any specific examples, feel free. But like, there's a dude in the room, incredibly knowledgeable, has great ideas. And I was like, I'll bet if we would have been able to tell him that one tiny piece of data, if we would have been able to tell him, he would have had the golden nugget that would have solved this problem for us, he or she. And that was yep. something that I saw numerous times. Specifically, it's like, hey, the cyber weapon school, those two people that came in from there, just because they weren't able to hear about this one thing the F-35 can do, or potentially, or whatever, they would have actually helped us a lot more. Is there any examples that you have about like security just becoming a true barrier to an answer?
Oh yeah. I mean, the joke in SOCOM is like, the best secrets are the ones we keep from each other. Like, you know, it's like you're sitting at the table looking yeah. the guy in the eye who you know can solve this problem. And you're like, I can't tell you. Yeah. I want to. Believe me, I do. Yeah. You know, and it's like that, like, and that's really hard. I mean, and when you think about the second and third order effects of just the culture, like the security culture of like over classification, over protection, yeah. what that does when you try to do, like, for example, when you start thinking about working with allies and partners, like, okay, hey, it'd be great if we didn't have to like carry this entire burden ourselves. How do we do things that are going to be joint and combined? Well, if I can't yes. even talk to the dude across the table who works in cyber who can solve this problem, how do I even begin to approach a company that might have this tech, much less an ally or a partner who we are literally going to go fight with? They don't know what we have. I don't know what they've got. Like, keeping secrets from each other, that's a massive problem. And, you know, and this is why we could do these exercises. We stress test these things. We go like push integration as far as we can to hopefully go find these things and then debrief them and then take action to resolve them. And, you know, once you get to that resolution step in the debrief or, you know, in the after action report, it's like, well, what can we do? And then somebody goes like, hey, sorry, like, that's just never going to happen.
Yeah.
I think similar to the, like, is AI ever going to drop a bomb question? It's like, what's it going to take for us to finally say, hey, you know what? Some of this stuff needs to be classified. And like, I trust and respect the people who are going to guard those secrets. Most of the things that we are protecting probably could either be redacted enough to be releasable at the right level, or we can just have our conversation about it, a reasonable conversation about things kind of in more generally to kind of yes. understand the state of the practice and the state of the art so that we can go, you know, problem solve.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And especially with some of the companies that you probably work with at Evergreen, is just like, we don't really care where the best ideas come from. And they're trying to build their company with the best talent. Not all of the best talent is inside of the United States. Some of these companies are multinational. Like, and when I say multinational, just the people that yeah. work for them. And like, they don't care where the talent come from. They don't care where the good ideas come from. But then when you go out and find these companies that potentially have the answer to some of our problems, is you say, okay, well, who's going to be working on this team? And are there any foreign nationals? And if the answer is yes, that's going to become yeah. a pretty significant problem. But
yeah, and I have to give massive credit to our classmate, Rudy Bowen, who worked at the headquarters in the strategy shop for the Space Force. So he graduates from school down at Maxwell, goes to SAS. Yeah, he's an Air Force guy, cross commissions into the Space Force. Comes up to the Pentagon, writes the commercial space strategy with the team, obviously, but he's like he's doing a massive load, and then gets this thing gets rolled out, and it's like, okay, hey, we have just told the world that we understand that we are going to exploit everything we have, you bet, but we are going to build only what we must, and we are going to buy everything else. That's it. Yeah. Like, bar none. Come to the table. If you got something, we want to hear about it. No, by the way, that's not just inclusive of the traditionals. That's looking at non-traditionals, and we're looking at allies and partners. And the Space Force is really making a concerted effort to think about, like, how do we engage these new companies? Also, how do we engage these, our countries, you know, the allies and partners here, to make sure that their companies can come to the table, and we can buy and sell to each other, and we can integrate and work with each other. And security always comes up. the Buy American always comes up. And the idea is like, all right, well, there are some things that we can do, very like tangible things that we can do in the near term, like making sure you don't have to have a joint venture in the United States in order to like do business with America. Like there should be a way for us to buy things from a French based company, and they should be able to buy stuff from us without going through the FMS process. And like, you know, there's a reason for a lot of that. But in general, like we just got to streamline those kinds of things. And I think kind of, you know, to our previous conversations, like what are the catalysts going to be to make that happen? And I think you're seeing it in space going so much faster because space is hard. It's capital intensive. The timelines are really long. Turns out they don't all work the first time. And oh, by the way, we're not going to be able to do this all ourselves. So you're seeing these market forces. And I turn it into like business concepts, because at the end of the day, this whole thing is a business. Now you have to consider incentive alignment. You got to think about like, all right, how do I bring these companies to the market? You know, reduce the barriers to entry, but also incentivize them to perform and work together and create a relationship so that we can solve these problems. And I point to the commercial space strategy because I think they're probably doing the most like right now to accelerate that process and make it work.
Yeah. And if I will say, people that I have found, and again, my wife is the business owner and entrepreneur in the McVeigh family. But as far as the things that we look at with some of our adversaries, when we're looking at great power competition, it is a business. It's like business acumen. It helps you understand some of the things that we're looking at when we talk about great power competition, specifically with China. Like aside from our fear that they would just invade Taiwan and like Russia invading Ukraine and some of these things, really the biggest driving force from some of our development of new tech and new capabilities is when a country just tries to control the market. And so when China tries to control shipping lanes, or they are owning every international port in the Western Hemisphere and in South America, or anything like that, is now a bigger threat to national security or anything that we're kind of looking at. So when you're looking at some of these military things, if you don't think that it's touching market strategy and market and business and people that understand how business works, those minds are required to kind of help us make good decisions on where we go and like what we put our money towards and our investments towards, at least I've noticed probably in the past like 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a brilliant point. And that remember back to our days at the academy when you went to military strategic studies and they said, hey, the dime.
It's hard for me to remember. It's hard for me to remember some of those times.
Yeah. And I'm sure we just washed most of that stuff away. But like one of the things that lingers in my brain is this idea of, you know, instruments of national power. And the model they shared was dime, you know, diplomatic, information, military, and economic. And you think about those as levers and like, okay, great. The $800 billion a year defense market, the annual budget that gets approved, like that is a massive lever. And like, that's great. But if you think about it, like, what is the military really designed to do? It is to go kill people and break their shit. Like that is it.
Yeah.
We're going to defend America, but it's really like, hey, we can reach out and touch you and please believe that we will do that. And we have done that very credibly, which I think is why everyone sort of goes like, I don't know if we want to really piss off the Americans, because like we know they'll come after us. Like that, like deterrence works beautifully in that scenario.
Yes, it does.
But what happens when you get to a place where it's like just below the threshold where like America's gonna go send an aircraft carrier? It's like just spread out enough that like, you know, it's in Africa and it's like not in Ukraine and it's not in China. And you're like, okay, do we really care? Are we really going to go spend a bunch of money? You know, like how do you handle all that stuff? And it's like, okay, now all of a sudden this death by 1,000 paper cuts problem starts to happen. And you go, okay, like I'm not going to be able to do this all myself as a United States military, but what can I do? Okay, I've got diplomatic missions in all these places. Great. I can collect information. I can share information with these places. But the thing that I have, the biggest lever I have, is the $25 trillion GDP of the United States of America. That's a pretty big lever when you think about it.
Yeah.
And then you go, okay, well, like how about all of the like of all the nations where we have diplomatic missions and where we're sharing information with, like you add their GDPs to this and you think about, okay, the power of those markets, the market forces that you can create, like that's what China's thinking about with Belt and Road. And I wish America would be thinking about not just in a defense industrial base, but like an American industrial base and like an allied industrial base and like use that more as a lever to dial up things where, yeah, okay, great. We do need hypersonic missiles and we do need B-21s and F-35s and GADs and ships. And we also need a bunch of other stuff like IT.
Yes.
Like if we spend a bunch of, yeah, you know, if we spend better on IT, it didn't take me 30 minutes to log into my email and we weren't trying to build it all ourselves internally to the military, like into the government. We just paid people like that are world-class and deliver excellent software products. And oh, by the way, like if it works great this year, but doesn't work next year, cool. You're out. Next one's in. Like it's transparent to the users because it's software and it's modular. I think that is that there's a lot of room to run there. And like you made an excellent point where like if you're a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Yes.
Okay. Like then you over-index on a lot of these like military solutions to problems that may be solved, you know, either diplomatically with information or economically.
Yeah. We talk about it. I will say something that's shifted from the start of my career to the, towards the back nine, if you will, but, is the conversations that we have in the bar aren't necessarily always, at the tactical level anymore. And they're not even at the military level, but they are kind of at the, dime piece.
Nailed it.
Smartest dumb people on the planet. You're United States Air Force. when we talk about some of those things, is I've had conversations in the bar about and asking somebody post a training mission where I just go, what world, like what geopolitical situation do you think would have to occur for us to shoot beyond visual range air-to-air missiles at other Chinese aircraft? I was like, what do you think would have to happen in the world for this scenario that we just went and trained to potentially? Not saying that we train against specifically Chinese aircraft or anything like that, but yeah, we do. And so, cause they train against us and whatever we train. Anyways, but I go, man, what geopolitical, and we talk about it and really what it kind of comes down to is they're just like global economic crash, significant disruption in our IT kind of infrastructure, massive cyber attack, or something that cripples like the United States economy. I don't know, but some of these things that we look at that we should invest more in to ensure they don't happen, because then everything will look like a nail very quickly. And if we devolve into a military conflict over something that starts as an economic issue, then that just shows that we haven't invested appropriately in the past. And so that's kind of the thing that I want to look at. And you just want to build a world that is more interconnected and cooperative. And just like you're talking about, is the more you can do that in a free market society, the better you're going to be off. Because if all of these countries are tied together economically, it's very difficult to go to war with each other.
Well, yeah. I mean, democratic peace theory like makes perfect sense. It's like, hey, we're making a lot of money and like life is pretty good here. Why would we want to fight each other over that? You know? And, you know, they say war is politics by other means. And like, I agree. I think the point that you're making there about like the conversation at the bar, I'll take a wild guess and say 90% conservatively of the people in that bar having that exact conversation, when they get out of the active duty and they go to pick their next job, what type of job do you think they go get? Overwhelmingly.
Defense contractor.
Right. I did the same thing. You know?
Yeah.
And I think the question is, like where, and we need good people at Lockheed and Northrop and Boeing and the primes. We also need really good people at some of these kind of new innovative companies. And typically you think about like risk, like, okay, like if I go to a startup, am I going to take all this career risk? Or, you know, like, is my equity going to be worth anything? It's like, well, what's the risk of you not doing that? Like, will that company make it across the hump? Will they ever build the right solution to the problem that you know about if you're not there sharing those insights, you know, and if you're not there helping those founders that like want to work 18-hour days to go build an AI fighter pilot that's going to fly against, you know, an F-16 guy. It's like that stuff is probably never going to happen unless you have people that sit in that bar, have that conversation, go, you know, I'm going to do something about this. And they pick, you know, it's like, hey, great. Go to Lockheed and help them be more innovated. Go to Northrop and help them move faster. Or go to a startup and help them like team with the primes, or, you know, go get into a program or whatever. Like all that stuff is good. Where I think that we're totally under leveraged is like the other piece of the equation, which is, hey, what if we get our, you know, our really smart cyber guys out there thinking about how to build better enterprise IT solutions and selling that globally so they can make a ton of money, but they can also deliver better solutions like to the market that we care the most about. I mean, earlier we were talking like, what, like why defense? Why does it matter? Like, I just don't care about anything else. But I also think about defense and like in the instruments of national power, I think about it much more broadly. Like I think about them as pieces in the puzzle as opposed to like this or that. It's not zero sum. So like, you know, the thing that I counsel and advise the companies that I work with and, you know, the folks on the government side that I work with is, hey, like this isn't a zero sum game. You don't have to think about like winning in defense tech or like getting into a program of record. You should be thinking about how to build a really great business and how to solve a meaningful problem that people are willing to pay you for. Yeah. And oh, by the way, like if you can create enough overlap between those two things, like a great IT solution or a great cybersecurity solution or a great new satellite service or a great new, you know, sensor for an airplane, like that's probably going to be great for everybody. And if you can think about how to like do that and like, okay, you're not going to be able to solve world hunger with like one particular solution, but like if you can build a credible business, it doesn't have to be $1 billion or $10 billion business. You know, if you can build a $50, $100, $200 million business that gets acquired by one of the primes, like you have solved a really hard problem. You've helped the primes because they weren't building it or couldn't build it. And then the warfighter gets what they need. Like what an incredible win-win-win scenario.
Yeah.
So I generally kind of think about the problem in the solution space more broadly than that, but it is definitely focused on security. And like you said, you know, how do we create more peace, you know, through diplomacy and democracy and, you know, economic prosperity?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the man, you hit, that's brilliant. Like I love it because that's the thing. It's just like where people, again, just like you're talking about with business, you need paying customers. And also the mark of a successful business is just having a really great product. And it's like, and what is a great product? It is something that somebody has determined that they have a demand for and you're supplying it. And so once you build that great product that nobody else does any better than you, then you are now going to provide that service to somebody else or provide that capability or good to somebody else. And then it's, and see how big you can make it. And that's something that I think is incredibly instrumental to both individual prosperity and business prosperity, global prosperity. But then it is the best way to protect us from each other. Because again, the more we work together, then if we're in business together, like I want that to be cooperative. And a bad business is people with animosity at the top, like within it, there's within themselves, and that's going to fail. And so if we have kind of business with everybody, then we can go from there. But I'm going to shift gears to something that you said right there, is get these people out and say, hey, these guys are going to go work in defense contracting after they get out of the active duty or get out from being a reservist or anything like that. But your defense ventures program that you got the opportunity to go do, exposing military members to some of these companies while they're still in uniform, that program, which ended unfortunately this year, talk to us about that program. And then it might get uncomfortable, but at the same time, like tell us why. Sorry, I'm actually going to back up. Every single time that I see something that you put out there on social media, you end it or start it with, this is how we win. Like, this is how we win. And then Defense Ventures program, when that ended, you put, this is not how we win. And so talk to me about that program, what it was doing, and then how, like, why is it important that we bridge this gap while people are still in uniform?
Yeah. I mean, Defense Ventures was really kind of the brainchild of Will Roper. And when he was in the seat, and it was actually Air Force Ventures first. And he and Mike Slaw had this idea. He's like, hey, if we could get more people out to Silicon Valley and a tech company, we could understand, you know, as fast as tech is moving, at least we can start to kind of understand it, or at least get a pulse check. And, you know, Mike Slaw was out there working on a company to help military members transition into tech companies. And he said, well, you know, we can certainly, like, we have all these connections and all this network out here. We can certainly help active duty people come out, get the experience, and go back into the military. Like, it's the same companies. These are the people you want to go interact with. So they said, sure, let's do it. And they sent a cohort, you know, cohort one, myself included, out to Silicon Valley for 2 months. And not even knowing how to spell VC, and just kind of like parachuted us in, said, hey, go out, you know, win friends and influence people, and just like, listen, ask a bunch of questions, listen, and see, you know, what they're interested in, what you're interested in, and see if you can find anything that's interesting to work on together. And I think the incredible serendipity that happens with programs like that is you get people, you know, like out in Silicon Valley who had never even thought about the defense. They literally grew up their whole lives, never even thought about the military, not once. Like, never thought, never crossed their mind. They weren't bagging groceries at a grocery store and seeing a person in a flight suit and thinking like, oh, I want to be you. That guy comes in, gets his groceries and leaves, and they're like on to the next customer. Right? Like, and I think for the most, like, there's a lot of places in America where that's true. So getting them exposed to, you know, people like us who are like, hey, we work on really hard problems too, and we need technical solutions, and we need smart people that care. Like, you know, how do you do it? That was a transformative experience for me. And then getting to immediately use that experience in the COVID task force, where we were calling all these people we met in Silicon Valley and like, hey, could you use your tech to help build a solution? And people were pivoting their entire companies to go support this stuff. And not because they thought there was going to be some massive government contract. It was just the right thing to do. And they were smart. Yeah. And like, we all wanted to get the pandemic over as fast as possible. So Defense Ventures was kind of born out of that experiment, if you will. And yeah, I was fortunate to actually work with Mike after my cohort to help him kind of feed my experience back to the program, help bring the next cohorts online, and then handed it off to an incredible woman named Maria to run it. And and Defense Ventures only got better. You know, it became Air Force Ventures, it became Defense Ventures. It became joint. They opened it up to reservists and guardsmen. They opened it up to civilians, government civilians, from all different agencies, all different backgrounds. They started putting them in different. It was at not just Silicon Valley. They did it in Austin and in Boston and in Atlanta, Georgia, and like all these places in between where like cool companies are doing cool stuff. So you have this incredible exposure on both sides, like what's going happen, and like. If you ask a question like, hey, why did $100 billion of private capital flow into defense tech in the last 5 years? It's not hard to imagine that when AFWERX came online and Defense Ventures started, you know, cross-pollinating across all these defense tech companies, or all these tech companies, that you start now all of a sudden getting people really caring about defense tech. It's like, okay, what is the most, if you just sort of do the math, you go, okay, what's the most high leverage activity I can do to create a network effect like that? Like, you send somebody TDY for 2 months to go spend time with an industry partner. Like, well, what do I get out of that? Well, like, okay, well, that person comes back. They understand business. They understand, they have networks of people that they've met. They understand how industry solves problems, and they bring all that back to them, you know, to their unit, to the problem that they're solving, to the service that they're working in. And it felt like we were reaching like this incredible period of time that like the DOD had never really seen before. And you know, DOD or DIU is sort of founded on the premise that like, hey, R&D used to be like 80-90% government. And today that's totally changed, and it's, you know, overwhelmingly private. So how do we leverage that private capital, that private R&D for government use cases? And I was like, okay, cool. Like Defense Ventures is how we're going to scale this. We're going to have people inside the government wearing a uniform that understand tech, they understand business, and they understand operations. Like, that sounds like the perfect mix of people that we need to go fight these wars. And, you know, one of the challenges that happens is, like, over time, the people that inherit these programs, they don't have the benefit of all that hindsight. They weren't yeah. there for the conception, and they don't get to see, like, all the intangibles. They're looking for, like, okay, well, like, how does that squadron show me the metric that shows me that they improved that squadron, or show me yeah. the metric that shows me they built a better mousetrap, you know, with a server or something. And unfortunately, the program, like, they got into this, their last contract, and it didn't get funded, and they discontinued it. And you saw these people kind of come out in droves, and obviously I'm passionate about this, but you saw these people kind of coming out and saying, like, hey, you're missing the picture. Like, you've lost the plot here. This is yeah. probably the best people program that we've ever had, and you just let it slip through your fingertips. And I've got to give credit where credit is due. A lot of smart people in the DoD were like, yeah, you're right. And, you know, when I use the, so, and I think people are working to try to put this back together. It's unfortunate, you know, like, so you asked, like, what has to happen to make a fundamental change, or to take this, like, leap and take some risk and do something? Like, unfortunately, it seems like Defense Ventures had to get canceled before people realized that, hey, this is actually super powerful and very impactful to a lot of people in these organizations. And it was, like, transformative to, like, a generation of people who are not just warfighters, but they're decision makers that are really trying to all help us win. So when you, like, the thing that I'm thinking about constantly is, like, how do we win? And I love to shine a light on things that I think are getting us closer, if for no other reason, just to help people sort of build a heuristic around, hey, this is what right looks like. This is like, I should be looking for things like this and trying to match patterns, because that's how our brain's going to work. And when things don't, it's easy to kind of shit talk and point at things that don't work. And we yeah. could talk the point PPPE process all day. We could point to Defense Ventures getting canceled. We could point to any number of programs that are all going sideways. And, like, to me, that's just not very productive. Like, yes, we need to look at things and understand why they're not working to hopefully fix them and turn them into things that do work. I just try to spend, but there's a lot of people that are trying to figure out why all these things are broken. Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of bitching and complaining on every Slack channel and every Signal group you're probably in. I try to focus my time on the things that I think are, like, really done well, and try to make them shining examples of what right looks like, and ultimately, like, will help us win.
Yeah. And dude, you're doing a great job of it. I love it. And one thing that I always kind of remembered about you both at the Academy, and then when we were at pilot training at good old Laughlin Air Force Base, kind of together is,
oh yeah.
When you're out there, is your, like, your specific, your individual, but then now, like, as Evergreen Industries, is bringing people together to just, one, the winning at the bar in Laughlin was just having a great time. And so when we're doing that, is like, you're bringing people together to win, and provide solutions to these very complex problems. And then something that I talk about all the time on the podcast, and something I saw on one of your posts, is that another benefit of getting military people out into some of these tech companies that, just like you're talking about, have never touched anything with the military or never even thought about it, is there have been companies that they've had employees walk out because they hear that their company is providing things to the military. And they just go, oh, well, we don't want to touch anything that's going to touch, like, anything with the military, because they're violent or it's warmongering or anything like that. But the interaction between military and industry that doesn't touch the military is something that people are going to understand. Me in the military, I don't want war to happen. I want to do everything in our power
yeah.
to prevent war from happening. And the only way that we can do that is to have people that are doing all of these different things that are going to help the, like, find problems to these solutions. Because if we don't have a solution to the problem, then we're just going to go out there and beat people with sticks, because that's the only thing we can do when we don't have a solution. And so that's kind of the thing that we want to look at, is the getting military people out into industry is going to show that most military people don't want war. And now they kind of build that trust, kind of that trust level that you were talking about earlier with AI. that now some of these companies will sit there and just be like, okay, fine, working with defense, with the Department of Defense or the government isn't such a bad thing because they now trust us a little bit more.
Yeah, and it's a two-way street. Like, yeah. Think about the master sergeant or the lieutenant commander who has been grinding for 15 years at their job, you know, and they know everything about the problem. Yes. They live it. They eat, sleep, breathe it every day. Like they could just, I mean, like I have to do it. They could wax poetic about all the problems here and just talk your ear off about it. And when you then send them out to a place like Hermias, you know, building like, you know, brand new manned and unmanned hypersonic vehicles, you put them out there and they just go like, oh my God. You know, you are thinking about a lot of the same problems I'm thinking about, and you have put your money where your mouth is and are solving it. And yeah, you have got all these people to come join you on this mission, and we can actually work together. Like, it's not an us versus them conversation anymore. It's a,
nope.
Hey, we're on the same team. So this challenge that I think a lot of startups, just business kind of in general deals with when trying to do business with defense is like, you know, A, we don't speak the same language, but B, we don't really know each other that well. So we don't really trust each other, and therefore we're skeptical, and therefore it, like, it's easier just to sort of resist and say like, yeah, well, I'll just kick the can down the road until the threat dictates that you must go faster and you must deliver better. And now you're like, well, I don't have any relation. I don't even understand the market. I don't even understand this tech, much less have the relationships to call and wrap my head around it, or even begin to start solving these things. And I think that's, like, to your point, where we're like, for like very low cost, you know, and for super high value, we can, as a nation, we can start bringing people together. And like, you want to talk about, like, this is how we win. I mean, look at what China is doing with civil military fusion. I mean, they are forcing these things together because they know it's so powerful and they know the impact it's having. And like, yes, we don't, like, in America, we don't have to do that because we have these incredible innovators and we have these really smart people. If we just facilitate it, it will naturally occur. And like, people want, yes, to do it. But if we unplug it, like, if it's going to be hard to have, like, no master sergeant's going to take 2 months of leave to go, you know what, I'm just going to go spend some time working with a company I think is really cool to try to learn about how they do stuff. Like, you can't do that.
No, just send them to do it. And then kind of the other one that I see all the time is, if you want to talk about taking care of our veterans, is this then shows them that they are like a transitioning veteran. Look at all the job opportunities that they have after they leave and the networking that they build.
Oh yeah.
And just so many veterans that can go out there and just be like, oh yeah, I have 20 other, just realizing that there is more out there that your skill set fits than just going out and, okay, if I don't get a job with Lockheed, then I'm done. Or just all these different things and just the opportunities, yeah, that are kind of opened up that I've seen. I didn't know some of the opportunities that I could utilize my skill set to help somebody out. When we were sitting at the academy and I would have told you that, hey man, you're going to be the CEO of a company that deals with defense tech startups, you would have told me I was crazy. Or maybe, like, not.
No, dude, I'm gonna be an F-35 weapons instructor.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
I'd be you. That's, if I could pick anything, I'd just be you.
Yeah, and it's like, I'll tell you what, on hundreds night when you and I were hanging out and drinking beers and stuff like that, at the time I was a logistics officer, and so,
right?
Yeah, like all these things that is cool. But all right, we're getting towards the end of our chat here. But no, this is awesome, man. Again, thank you so much for taking the time. But one thing that I wanted to kind of discuss before we might kind of Tarantino the story back to something you said earlier about your time actually being a pilot in the J. But budgets, we talk about budgets, and as far as like the process that we have is budgets, having a signed defense budget that actually does allow for a 12-year utilization cycle or 12-month utilization cycle versus a CR that allows for a 6-month utilization cycle towards end of year funds. What does that do to a defense tech startup that just gets into the market?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll be completely honest. Every company that I work with, they plan for it and they make this part of their go-to-market strategy. Like it is at this point, it is just an assumption that we are going to make. It's going to happen. Like, what a shitty proposition.
Yeah.
But that's the reality. Like, we don't build companies for the market we wish we had. You got to build companies for the markets that you are going to work in and all the realities, the good, the bad, and the ugly that come with it. Because guess what? Like, this is not a market for the faint of heart. It's great that you're 19 and you want to drop out of college and you're going to want to go work on missiles. And like, you want to build technology. Like, I love it. Thank you for wanting to be on Team America. You have to realize that this is the most sophisticated customer problem, challenging market, real no shit company product that you're going to build. Because like, if you come up and you bring it weak, or God forbid you oversell it and it doesn't do the thing that you say it's going to do, people are going to die. And it's not just going to be Flash with his warship of F-35s going down range to soak up an SA-21 Bravo. It is potentially, you know, when you think about like how all these things are connected, you talk about long range kill chains, like one break in the chain has these cascading effects. And yep. Like that is the seriousness of this market. And that's why we have to figure this out, because even though we accept this as a reality, but the lumpiness in the market, it's hard to forecast. It puts a ton of pressure on the acquisitions community to buy. Like, you know, they don't even know when they're going to get their money, how much of it they're going to get. And then they've got a rush to spend it. So they don't have any bandwidth to go really do market research, wrap their head around new tech, like really try to forecast where the market's going. Like, they're just trying to execute. And when you're in execution mode all the time, you don't really have to really do the big picture thinking that is necessary to like solve some of these really complex problems. So yeah, I think the single great, like actually one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, we talk about the threat evolving. I think we're our own greatest enemies here. And the CR is the biggest threat to national security that we have. And that's not a political statement. That's a fact. Like if you put the people who are building and selling, or building, selling and buying these solutions in a place where they're fighting with one hand behind their back, it's like, okay, like now we can't help each other. And that's a real problem. So I think getting the CR resolved, getting budgets passed, making Congress effective, like, and we got to help them. Like, we got to help them with that. And part of that is, you know, we got to elect people that understand the impact of business, that understand the problems we're solving, that are working in this market, and like are serious about getting it fixed and like doing what it takes to get things on time. Like, unless we start holding each other accountable for that, it's just not going to happen. And I don't want to live in that world. So part of what I'm trying to do is crank on that lever, that like, you know, the E, to make sure that they realize like, hey, you know, there are huge benefits to unlocking the economic potential of these companies, and it creates jobs and it brings more capability. And like, you don't have to spend as much on defense. Like there's a net positive that happens by solving this one particular problem.
Yeah. And the way I kind of equate it to a military or fighter pilot or airlift pilot kind of construct is, just imagine if you just went out every single day and executed, and you're just like, hey, you don't get to mission plan and you don't get to debrief because you don't have time or the resources to do so. And it's just like, and you just go out there and you just execute every single day. Hope it works out. Hope you win. But like, you're never going to learn from the lessons. You're never going to figure out new tactics or be able to develop new tactics because you had no decision space on a debrief to learn the lessons and then a mission planning kind of window to be able to implement them before execution. And so that's kind of what we're looking at right now with some of those. And that's how companies are operating. And it's not the most optimal environment to live in, to kind of put it lightly. And I agree with you that
it's incredibly,
we're our biggest threat.
Yeah. It's incredibly suboptimal. And I've spoken like a expert weapons officer. I love the way you put that. Like, and that's the thing, as an instructor pilot, I was always thinking about, I was like, hey man, like, how do you make better decisions? That's all you should be thinking about. Like, great. Yeah. I can teach you how to fly. I can teach you how to like, you know, punch the buttons. I can teach you how to do all that stuff. But like, I it's really hard. I can give you frameworks, but like, you have to internalize how to make better decisions and give yourself some space. And when we jam everything into this, you know, this like 6-month CR and we restrict people from thinking big, and like it has this cascading effect. And I'd love to hear some smart people come on and think about how we can like all work together on this.
Yeah.
Because I do think there's a lot of people out there that are really smart and have really good ideas on this. But unfortunately they're probably just throwing up their hands and saying like, hey, this is a reality of the market. I'm like, okay. Like on the one hand, that is what I'm telling founders, because that, like, if you have to go to market today, this is what you should be thinking about. On the other hand, I'm thinking like, all right, how do we remove this roadblock so that we can all win better together?
Yeah.
It's probably the most impactful conversation we could have.
Oh, definitely. And that's the other one. That's the one too, is just like, I venture to agree with me if it's true, or tell me if it's true, is that another barrier to entry is that instability. As you just go, effectively, you're asking a company to come work for, an organization. And hey, by the way, you're going to live paycheck to paycheck for the duration of your contract. And that's just the kind of life. And you can kind of see what it does on the stress level and decisions that a family makes when they're living paycheck to paycheck. There is a parallel to the business world on being able to do that and just be like, I'm not necessarily sure I'm going to get all the funding that I was told I was going to get or when I was going to get it. And now I have to just kind of live that paycheck to paycheck kind of life. And that's, again, not going to be the most beneficial for everybody. But
yeah, all right, particularly in venture. I was just going to say in venture backed startups, there's, you know, like the impact of that is actually companies can generally raise money with a good idea. You can even raise more money if you get a little bit of traction, you get a sliver or two, you know, you make some traction. But what you can do is you can over leverage yourself. You can outkick your coverage in a really big way. If you lever up and you take all this venture capital, you sell all your company in the hope that, yeah, I'm going to be able to like hit the market cycle right on time. And I'm going to be able to do all these things I got to do with the warfighter, with the acquisitions people, with the requirements people, with the appropriators, with the authorizer. I'm going to be able to do all that and like time it perfectly. So one of these CR, you know, like I'm in between CRs and I've got it nailed. Like that is, it's already hard, as we've discussed, yep, like to solve this problem. It's even harder to build, you know, a startup in this market, given that sort of scenario. I mean, like the luck and timing aspect of that is, you know, incredibly hard. But to your point, like I think in this, like what we're going to see if we don't fix some of this is, yeah, not only are these companies going to overleverage themselves, like they're probably not going to be able to, you know, get across the valley of death. And the investors are going to say, well, hey, we've done our part. We took the risk and invested in these companies. You didn't do your part and fund them when they could build these things because of the CR for any number of reasons. Well, we've got to go find another place to invest so that we can get better returns in a market that actually is viable. And like the worst case scenario would be the money dries up, the founders leave the market, and like we have this brain drain of people that care about defense tech, but they just can't execute because of, you know, because the system, we've made it so immeasurably complex and challenging that a non-traditional company really can't be successful systemically.
Yeah.
So it sucks that you've got all the stress that you're already taking on by working at a startup and that you're already, you know, that you're already incurring by working in the defense market. But like the fact that like it could all just go away. And now we're going, hey, but we're actually going to write you contracts there. Like, yeah, we've seen this movie before. Like, cool, we're gonna go build a better dog walking app because I know I can make $1 billion. Like,
exactly.
Let's not let that happen.
Yeah, no kidding. Or some of these venture capitalists go invest, taking a big leap here a little bit, I understand. But like some of these VCs like go invest in companies that are now providing a service to maybe an organization that doesn't have our best interest, maybe another country that is looking for some of these things as well. But like when you look at some of those, is you want people to invest in the things that suit our interests. And so when you create something that is now a barrier and they're going to go find somewhere else because that's the market. And even if a nation like China, like a communist country, they are still in the market and they are doing pretty good. And so those are the kind of things that we're looking at. But all right, man, I do got a question for it, because I want to hear some of this stuff
So you're a C-130 pilot. I know, going way back, but that is you by trade. And dude, you had a hell of a career. If you have any stories that you can tell us about Benghazi or Crimea or any of that kind of stuff, let's close it out with a kind of there I was, or a war story, if you will.
Man, I do have a lot of those stories. Unfortunately, I can't tell any of them, but I can tell you.
Hey, security, like allude to something. We'll just talk around it.
Yeah. So a guy I know, there was a really cool opportunity that we got when I went out to Japan. I was a brand new in the C-130J pilot. I'm one of the first guys out there, and we got to go do a pretty cool mission down in Australia. They do these joint chiefs of staff exercises, JCS exercises. So we're down there doing Talisman Sabre. We're training with like the Sasser, you know, they're like special operations dudes. We're dropping them. We're doing these full mission profiles, like refueling helicopters, doing airdrops, doing infills, exfills. It's like, it's the real deal. It's full up down there. And when you're flying around the outback and you're doing, you know, you're flying with the Aussies, like they're like, hey man, anything goes. Like we've looked up the street. We got to know like what's coming our way. So we're not pulling any punches. You don't have any restrictions you have at the knitter. It's like game on. So it's like generally a 2 week thing. We spend the first week there. We're doing like a lot of the training and kind of prepping and stuff. And we get a break in between, and they had conveniently timed the exercise around a holiday called Anzac Day, which is like their 4th of July, but times 10, like everybody wakes up. So the first thing you do is you have a sunrise service, and you like, you know, you pay homage to those that have gone before you, and everyone's there. It's not like a morning parade at the Air Force Academy where you hate it, you don't want to go, and maybe you skip
try to
it.
Get out of it. Yeah. Try to get out of it.
This is a scenario. Yeah. Like everyone's there. 100% of the people are there. They're decked out in their uniforms. You have this massive ceremony, and then like, you know, the sun rises, and at like 5:39, the first beer gets cracked. You know, you're like, okay, like this is gonna be a long day, because these guys, this not only do they work hard, they play hard. So yeah, we have a couple of beers in the squadron. We do some stuff like you do. And then like we're downtown. It's like 7 a.m. We are three sheets to the wind. And I'm at an establishment that serves beverages. And this burly Sasser guy looks at me, and he's like, oh, you're a pilot. I'm like, yeah, he knows, because we're all in our uniforms. he goes, the problem with pilots, you guys can't drink. And I was like, what?
First off,
check yourself. Like maybe you're in America, or like maybe you're in Australia, but in America, like we pride ourselves on the ability to party. And he was like, oh yeah, all right. Well, I'll bet you a beer that I can get a drink faster than you. I'm like, all right, well, never one to back away from a competition. Like, let's go, man. And he goes, ready, set, go. So I'm like jumping, hollering, screaming, trying to get the attention of the bartender. And he just goes, boop, and flips open the tap to the beer on draft. And beer is just going everywhere. It's, you know, it's flowing. Like he hits two of these things. Like they're all, the beer is going all over the floor. And the bartender comes running over. And like, you know, the bouncer comes running over. And the guy, like the whole time, the guy's been filling his beer underneath the tap. And right before the bouncer comes over, he looks at me and goes, I fucking got ya. And he slams the beer, gets tackled by the bouncer. We're kicked out of the bar. And by like 7:05 a.m., like we are hammered. We've been kicked out of the bar.
Kicked out of our first bar.
Yeah. And I've already lost a bet. Like, and I've proven myself unworthy in Australia on their day. But that is, I think that's a testament. Like when we start thinking about allies and partners, it's like, okay,
yeah,
you know, these are people that not only are like super serious about what they do, and they're incredibly competent, and they know how to bring it hard, they're also a hell of a lot of fun to party with. And I would like, yeah. I would go back to Australia in a second to go work with those guys.
Oh yeah. Oh, for sure. No, that's awesome. And I'll tell you what, like the mark of a really good career is like those stories when you're kind of talking about, like, yeah, I can't tell you any of those stories. And you're just like, no one's ever going to hear about them, but you know what you guys know what you did and you went out there. And then those are the types of things that then make the times in the bar with the Aussies like all that much sweeter. Cause you just know like the shared experiences that you guys got, and just kind of like the mutual benefit we provide each other when we're working together with those allies and partners and all over the world is something that I know that was a big part of your career. And it's something that is important to you, as you kind of transition and now have transitioned to kind of this next phase of life. So, man, I appreciate all the words and the time, all this, and dude, best of luck, with all the ventures that you're in, and keep these coming because we need to solve some of these problems. And these companies that are coming to you for help, like you're moving the ball forward. And I know that one of your mottos of your company is build the airplane in flight. And these incredibly difficult things to do, such as build an airplane while it's flying, is something that is incredibly important to not only warfare and the warfighter in the event deterrence fails, but also deterring conflict. And that's really what we're trying to do at all times, is not to go to war. And these are the people and the problems that we need to solve to make sure that happens. So any parting words for our listeners and viewers before we kind of close this one out, other than the fact that, man, it's been great to see you.
Yeah, we need to do this more often. That's number one. Number two, thanks again for having me on. I obviously get fired up about this stuff. I could talk about it forever, and often I talk too long. But I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to share some of these thoughts. You know, I became a big LinkedIn guy when I was getting out of special operations, and they said, hey, you know, we are quiet professionals, but we're not silent professionals. And when you get out, you're entering a world where there's a lot of noise. So your job is not to add to the volume. Your job is to create signal. And that stuck with me as a guy who traditionally really didn't talk about stuff and didn't share, to being much more comfortable with sharing stories and being more vocal about the things that I think are most important, and trying to send the signal to the people who also believe those things. And if we can, and the goal is not to find everyone, like we just need to find the critical mass of people who really want to win, who resonate with that signal, to say, okay, yeah, I'm in, like, let's go work on these things. Like, those are the people that I want to help win. That's the airplane that we're going to build in flight. And I really appreciate you bringing me on to talk about this stuff. Like, I have been thinking about, you know, like where we came from at the Academy, and like, you know, how long it's been. And it's just, it doesn't feel like that long, although it probably looks that way. but I'm confident that the best years are ahead of us. And a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, you know, we're going to make happen. And that's just incredibly exciting.
Dude, I'm with you. And thanks again, for everything you do. We will do this again. And then also hopefully get some work together in the future. So for everybody, Forrest Underwood, Flash McVeigh for the Afterburn podcast. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to us. Hit the subscribe button, or listen to us and share us to wherever you guys get your podcasts. And that's it. Enjoy the rest of your guys' day. Take it easy, everybody.
See ya.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.